In this episode, I interview Sam Webster from foragingforages.com. Sam is a wild food expert and foraging guide from the UK. She's a lovely lady as well, and I've learned a lot from her over the years. She was one of my instructors at one point when I was learning how to become a wild food foraging guide at one point in my life during lockdown when things went crazy. She's really knowledgeable. We go deep and dive into all things wild food, wild fungi, talk about recipes. We also touch on her slightly strange obsession with all the deadly toxic mushrooms as well, which is actually really interesting to talk about, and a couple of really bizarre yet fascinating facts about how she uses wild foods, and not just for eating. There's some really interesting uses that she has. I won't spoil the surprise, but wait till you start to hear her talk about conkers, or the horse chestnut, and how she uses that. It's mind blowing. So, without further ado, I hope you enjoy this episode. Go and check Sam out on @foragersam on Instagram, and give her a like, give her a follow, and say hello. She's a lovely lady, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Speak to you soon. Cheers. Bye. So hi, Sam. Welcome to the Truffle Forager podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to have a chat with you. A bit nervous. I've not done one of these before.
It's all good. Yeah, it's completely normal to be nervous. I'm nervous. I still get really nervous. I mean, I've only done a handful of these, but I get nervous. You know, I had butterflies in my stomach this morning already just thinking about it. So if that's you as well, all good.
All good.
So yeah, it's really, really great to have you on, and you know, it's good to reconnect with you as well, like properly, and see your face again. I know we touched base back in the middle of the pandemic as well, you know, back when, but at least for me, I was a bit of a wandering soul trying to, you know,
it was
become a forager time. And
although I did quite enjoy the pandemic because there was nobody in my woods.
More mushrooms to forage, more things to find.
It was just more quiet and less litter and less poo, and it was just nice. Everybody was home.
Very nice, very nice. Well, as I said, it's a pleasure to have you, and really looking forward to picking your brain. And I know you're really up to speed with your mushrooms and poisonous mushrooms as well. You said you were really interested in, which is, you know, I'm sure we can jump into that a bit later. But just to sort of bring the audience and the listeners up to speed a little bit, could you just share a minuscule bit about, like, you know, how you got into wild food foraging, and also what you're up to now?
Okay, so I've always kind of gone for walks with my mum and my nan as a child, and we'd pick blackberries and damsons, and we'd make jam. So it was a sort of typical, you know, forager story. And then when I moved in with my husband, at the back of where we lived, there was a canal, and that's got so much fruit. So I was like a scrumper. And my husband bought me a foraging course for my birthday, and that was it. Something inside me just went, yeah, you ain't never going back. I think within an hour of doing that foraging course, I'd booked on to like two others, and it just became an absolute obsession. I've always been like interested in mushrooms. My first ever mushroom book I actually bought when I was 16 for my GCSE art project, just so I could copy the pictures. I didn't realize I was buying a Bible. And just like the more I forage, the more I find out, the more I get excited. And actually now my journey is kind of taking me down more of the geeky side of things.
Okay.
I've been getting a microscope out and looking
at
spores, and I mean I've no idea really what I'm doing. I'm right at the beginning of the journey of that, but I'm getting into the non-edible stuff now. I'm just going, wow, it's just cool.
Very nice, very nice. I've been dallying with you know, the thought of getting a microscope and taking it to that next level. I've even been looking at videos online of people doing, and because of technology now, things like DNA sequencing potentially can be done at home, like with these kits that are, you know, I don't know, hundreds of pounds rather than thousands of pounds. But you know, I'm not really dipped my toe into there yet, so it's really cool to speak to someone who has dip their toe into the microscopic side of things, at least.
It's been It started sort of September, October. So this last 6 months, I've just totally turned into a nature nerd, which has been lovely because I've left my job that I had before and now setting up on my own, and I've had a lot more time to research and go for walks and find stuff. It has actually been like a mind-blowing journey. I've got really into moss and bryophytes as well, and I
Moss and
have
what, sorry?
bryophytes. Bryophytes is the technical
Do
name of moss.
explain. Oh, is it? Okay. That's the technical name, right?
That's the scientific name. And in the last 6 months, I've discovered two ridiculously rare species because I've been out and I've been looking. So I found a blackening
Of
chanterelle
moss.
of mushrooms.
Oh, of mushrooms. Okay, sorry.
One was a blackening chanterelle, which I thought was just a winter chanterelle, and I was corrected on that by a good friend, Jesper Launder. Thanks, Jesper.
Yeah.
And then the other one, this is where the moss thing comes in. I found little teeny tiny, like maybe like a millimeter across, mycorrhizal bryophyte mushroom, Luteodiscus bryophyllus, which I had no clue what it was. I had a look in temperate Europe. The fungi of temperate Europe wasn't, and I was like, oh my God.
So sorry,
So
Sam,
I.
before you move on, that for the people who don't know some of the long words you've just mentioned, the mycorrhizal bryophyte mushroom, explain to us what's going
Mycorrhizal
on
bryophyte. So
here.
that's a fungi that has a mycorrhizal relationship with moss.
Okay.
So mycorrhizal, that means sort of they share or steal nutrients from each other. So they've got a special symbiotic relationship. So it's a fungus, a mushroom that's got a special relationship with a particular type of moss. And I've discovered that she's quite a few of them. And this one that I found, it was a bit of Grange Gardens in Staffordshire, just out with the kids. I got one photo of it because it was like, Mom, come on, hurry up.
Yeah.
So I got one picture of it. I shoved a chunk of it in my pocket and brought it home to look at it under the scope. And like I said, I had a look in the Fungi of Temperate Europe, which is like my Bible. And it wasn't in there, couldn't find it. So I put it out there online, and this mycologist and bryologist, so mushroom guy, moss guy, on one of
The
the moss
perfect
species,
person for this one.
perfect person.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, I want to be friends with you.
Yeah.
He said, oh, that looks really interesting. Can you send me a sample? So off I trot with a bag of moss down to the post office, and a day later he messages me to say, I found an undescribed species. There's no samples of it in Kew Gardens, so it's getting DNA sequenced, and off it goes to Kew.
That's so exciting.
Yay. Yeah,
Do you have any impact, sorry, influence over what it might be called? Like,
I think it'd already be, it's not undiscovered, it's just
Okay.
undescribed. So I just think that nobody really knows about it.
How
But my
interesting.
next question then is, like, is it a really rare fungus, or is it just so small and there's not enough nerdy people out there looking for it? And that kind of then brings me back to foraging, because that's how I got into being this nature nerd. And I kind of, that's where I want to go now with my teaching, is that draw people in with the food, and then just turn them all into nerds.
I like nature nerd as a phrase. That's such a good that's a I'm sure that Instagram handle is already gone, but
Yeah, probably
yeah,
is.
I no, I love that. Brilliant. And it reminds me actually of because I interviewed Jesper, your the guy whose course you said you're on, and that first time round, and he opened my eyes and said, because I thought initially with truffles, obviously one of my things is truffles, I thought there was only 20 to 30 species in the UK. He was the one that opened me up and said, actually no, Ben, there's more like 90 plus. But
Hundreds,
I think a big part of that is because no one's looking, and these,
yeah.
well, the same thing as you saying, this moss thing is really small. Truffles obviously underground, so
It's,
people aren't looking and seeing these things. So there's so much to be discovered, and you've just mentioned it, you potentially can go out there, get into foraging and discover brand new species and potentially get your name somehow weaved into that as well, if that was even part of the combo.
exciting.
Very exciting. So
A question I wanted to ask you is for those people who are listening who maybe they've come onto this podcast or they're watching this on YouTube for the very first time, and they're not really into foraging yet, but they've heard of it and think it's interesting. Like, how would you explain what wild food foraging is and why it's important and why it's important to you?
So it's the best thing ever. it's good on so many levels, like mental health wise, you know, just going out in the woods has helped me no end, especially like in the last 6 months, because obviously I took a bit of a dive after a rather toxic relationship. And just being out there, feeling the wind on your face and seeing all the green things. And foraging helps you to lift layers of green blindness. As a forager, you might not get it yourself, but for somebody who's never foraged, and I get a lot of people saying this on my courses, that I didn't realise how much stuff there is out there. And by foraging and learning all the different plants, and even just looking, I mean, the way I forage is I look for different shapes and different shades of green, and that is how I spot all the different species. Or if it's fungus, I look for circles. So by starting out foraging and going out with the mindset of looking at the green stuff, you're taking that green blindness off. You're seeing more than just, oh, it's a tree, oh, it's grass, oh, it's this. So that is a really important way of helping you to reconnect with nature. This whole reconnecting thing seems to be a big thing at the moment. I've been doing all these things for years, and just, that's not what everybody does. Do you not just go out and find a nice patch of moss and lie in it and look at a tree? Apparently that's nature bathing. That's what I do just because that's what I like doing. So you've got all those like fantastic mental health things that you get from foraging. You get an exercise, and then you get in like food. And I love quite childish, and I love the whole treasure hunt. So the food, the plants, the mushrooms are the treasure. And I also really like puzzles. So it's the fun of getting it home and going, right, what is this? Let's look through books. Let's try and, you know, like one of the escape room type things, you've got, you know, 60 minutes to identify this plant and eat it, and you know, it might be alive at the end, might not. But then it's like, so you've gone out and you've seen stuff, and then you go out again, and then you try it. You're exercising another sense. You know, how often do you go out for a walk and use your taste buds? Unless you've got coffee with you, you don't. So it's another way of that connection. You know, you walk through a field of wild garlic and you're like, oh, garlic stinks. Taste it, and it's like, oh. You know, for me, it's like, oh, I've missed that. I've not had that since June. I had my first little taste of it the other day, and it was just like, oh, pesto pasta, wild garlic pesto pasta. It just brought it all back, and it's like, I can't wait. So you know, it's exercising your senses. You know, your sight, your smell, your taste, if it's safe to taste, and even feel and texture. You know, you're using your senses. You're kind of connecting with your humanness. It's not the word I wanted to use, but you know, do you know what I mean? Where it's you're going back to being not modern day man, but like Neolithic man, where we're like relying on all of these senses for survival, getting back in tune with being alive rather than just having a phone in front of you or, you know, sat watching the telly. You're connecting with everything around you, and it really, really makes you appreciate like where food comes from and the delicate balance of what we do. And I'm really starting to become aware of the impact, you know, sort of no food we eat is impact free. You know, I don't want to get in the whole veganism argument, but no food we eat is impact free. And by foraging compassionately, sustainably, by being aware that every mushroom you take is a habitat for insects, which are then useful for pollinating, that's obviously then going to have an impact on the fruit. You know, so everything you do is having an impact. And by being aware of that, it then makes you appreciate things a lot more. So, you know, you look at your plate of food and you go, I've collected that, I've cooked it, and I'm going to eat it. And I put all the effort in, rather than just nipping down the supermarket, getting in the microwave meal, pinging it in, and there it is.
So much more rewarding, right? That's a really beautiful answer you just gave to what is, you know, quite a big question. I really appreciate how you answered that. It was great. And it reminded me as well, you were triggering all these experiences that, you know, because the last time that we were together, I was shadowing you on a foraging course, right? Yeah. You know, obviously things didn't pan out for me and that company, but whatever. We also had Flavor Fred George on that as well, which was, you know, he's another great guy, mind blown. But it was just a walk of flavors. You know, we're eating like the needles. But the one that really blew my mind was, and I might have got this completely wrong, but at least this is how I remembered it, was the immature rowan berry seed pod things that then we nibbled on them. And you're like, yeah, nibble on this and tell me what flavor you find. Yeah. And it was like an aftertaste, like a really sweet, nice aftertaste of marzipan.
Mm-hmm.
And which was just like...
rowan flowers.
Just crazy, because like there's all the, and how many other plants and mushrooms, you know, but plants definitely, like have they got this like unique flavor, which maybe we knew about years ago and just have forgotten about because, you know, there's a mass produced ingredient that grows much quicker, more efficiently in God knows where, and we just import it type of thing. But I really loved that. And
I've just put out an advert for some courses. I was doing one in my village from raising money for my local school, and one of the villagers, I put on a picture of a basket full of plants, and then one of the villagers says it looks great for rabbits. And I was like, please come on my course, because I really want to change your mind about that, because people who haven't foraged just don't realize the difference of flavor. And that's what blew me away when I first started. It was like, oh, it's all just going to taste like grass, isn't it? And to add, grass doesn't all taste the same. Some grass tastes amazing. Mm. you know, so it's just the variation. You know, like you say, you've got marzipan, you've got citrus. If you go down like the pines, you've got all the different lemons, grapefruits, oranges. You've got sorrel, leafy citrus, you get iron ear, you get, there's so many different flavors. Herby, like mugwort's one of my favorite plants, that just tastes gorgeous.
Because one of my things is, I'm very interested in the plant side of things as well, and I like those little flavor hits and stuff, but obviously I'm way more obsessed with mushrooms. But I think part of it is because sometimes I'm a bit like, oh, these plants are all just a bit, they have like a bit of flavor in there, but then they're just a bit greeny and leafy and just not really doing it for me. But I know there's probably a way to like find how to eat that specific thing at its like maximum potential. And I was like, do you have any good examples of whereby, because I know when you go around and you ask people to taste, like for me, you know, like what's it, garlic mustard, the you know, that one for me, that's, and I think you said even before that, that's like a love or hate type of flavor. But as that example, maybe there's an example where you can eat that particular leaf, or another example if you've got a better one, in one way, and it's like but then you do it in a different way or accompanied with something else, it's like, have you got any examples of like like that?
All of it. I mean, a lot of people go.
How long have you got, Ben?
A lot of people come on the courses and they're like, oh, it's a bit bitter. Or it's a bit overpowering and stuff. And it is. It's all about using the flavor. You wouldn't go out there and eat a handful of parsley or coriander. Most people wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a plant out there, Herb Robert, Stinky Bob, best name ever. It's part of the geranium family. It will be within 500 meters of your house. It's a prolific weed. And that tastes really strongly of coriander. And on its own, just to eat it out of the ground, it is a bit like, oh God. But if you chop that up in a salad of all the other different wild greens, or put it over the top of your curry, or anything where you use coriander, I make a really nice cucumber and herb Robert writer with it. Just blitz it all up, and it is lovely. And it's very much a case of remembering that nature is like the supermarket, and you wouldn't go to the supermarket, buy one ingredient, and therefore have a plate of food. They are individual ingredients that you then have to process and do stuff to make yourself a meal. So with all of the wild greens themselves, you can just eat them on their own as a salad, but mix them up. You know, mix your jack by the head, your garlic mustard, your herb Robert, your cow parsley, even wild garlic, sorrel, dandelion leaves. Just mix it all up, chop it all up, and then cover it with a bit of dressing, and it's the best salad you'll ever taste. I think the way we run courses where you go, oh, you know, try this leaf, it can put some people off, because on their own they are a bit, oh, okay, because we're not used to having sort of more bitter flavors. All of our salads and our vegetables have been selectively bred to be sweet. I mean, when I was a kid, it could just be I've got older and more used to bitter flavors, but other people have said the same. I hated cauliflower. It was bitter and disgusting, but now actually it's really sweet. And that's through, you know, generations of selective breeding to get the sweeter flavors, because we have become really accustomed to sweet, sugary things. If that's what we like, it's quick energy. I was having a chat a couple of years ago with a lady who was all about nutrition and gut biome. She was saying that humans' guts haven't actually evolved since we were Neanderthals. So it's actually the bitter stuff that's really good for us, and the sweet stuff. Our ancient ancestors would have maybe got a tablespoon a year of sugar. And now I could probably say I've eaten that in a breakfast. So it took me a long time of regularly eating wild food to go, actually, my taste buds are getting used to and really enjoying these more bitter flavors. But any sort of processing, or playing around with the flavors is going to make it way better than just eating it straight out of the ground. I mean, there are plants out there that I will eat straight out of the ground, like sorrel. And I do like a little nibble on cacao parsley, but ground elder, that's my favourite. I have actually planted that in my garden. Probably going to live to regret it, but I love that stuff.
I was going to ask you a question, actually. Not on ground elder. Sorry to interrupt you. When you said planted in your garden, we all go crazy for wild garlic, me also, and I know you're a big fan. And I was adamant that I was going to try and get some. And I know there's like a long life cycle to like them seeding. I think you told me that. Like six years, is that right?
6 or 7 years from seed to a plant that then is then mature enough to flower and produce more seeds.
Right. So I went somewhere where there was producing seeds, stole some seeds, and then tried to sprinkle them and plant them in the garden. So far, no luck. I don't know if you've known anybody who's had success taking seeds and
not that I'm aware of. I have I hope that no coppers are listening. I have, with permission, taken it from bulb and let it do its own thing that way. And I think that's kind of the way of doing it. Just let
but only with the landowner's
landowner's permission, ladies and gents. Definitely. He said it was okay, it's fine. I planted that. I first of all planted it in the pot because I was like, oh God, this is going to go crazy. And now I'm just like, actually, I want it to go crazy. So I planted it in a shady spot in my garden. And it's been there for about 3 years now. So there are mature bulbs and they flowered and dropped the seeds. And because I think they've sat there in the ground where they're supposed to be, so that, you know, they get the right conditions for germinating. I had last year's little tiny ones, and the first year seeds are only about an inch tall.
How cute.
So yeah.
So let's talk wild garlic recipes. I know you said wild garlic pesto. Is there anything else that either you've done in the past that you love, or you've got on your agenda to do because you've seen a recipe or something like that? I'd love to get one or two golden nuggets.
Yeah.
Out of you.
So I mean, the best way of preserving wild garlic is lacto fermenting. So if you try and dry it, it loses its flavor. If you freeze it, it goes mushy after a couple of months in the freezer. So lacto ferment is where you blitz it up, you cover it with sort of between 3 and 5% salt, and then you just, it lives forever and gets more umami, garlicky, yummy.
So sorry, just to detail that, so you blitz it up in a blender, and then you make like a water solution with, as
no
you
no
said.
No, just pure salt, just cover so it in just, salt, massage it with salt, and then put it in a jar.
Okay.
And that's it.
So when you say 2 or 3%, you're weighing the weight of the
So if you've got like 100 grams of wild garlic, you want
2 or 3 grams of
five
salt type of thing.
5, 10 grams of salt, something like that. 10 might be too much. Got 5 grams of salt, and then you just sort of really massage it around and then put it in the jar and leave it. And then the salt draws out the liquid, it kills all by the lactilia bacteria. So it goes through this fermentation process, and it's too salty for anything else then to grow.
And what's that good to eat with?
Everything.
Just everything.
Yeah, just everything. I use it instead of garlic cloves in a bolognese or whatever. Put it in risotto. Put it on a cracker with cheese. but what I've also done with it, so last year, for the company I worked with, we made a dustbin full of lacto garlic, and we were portioning it up for events, and at the bottom there was just all of this garlic juice, and there was no way I was wasting that. So I bottled all that up, and
most
and
people would be like, ugh. Probably.
Oh, it was amazing. So it is quite salty, but then I've mixed it even more with salt. I've mixed it with some soy.
Okay.
Soy sauce, lacto fermented wild garlic soy sauce. Oh,
is that a winner?
That's a winner. That's like, you know, when you go to a posh restaurant and they just put like 3 or 4 dots of something tasting.
Yeah. That's amazing. The good thing about doing that type of thing as well is it's preserved as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I found that wild garlic does actually keep quite well in the fridge anyway. But
yeah, if you put it in a Tupperware or something, then it'll keep for a couple of weeks.
But I think preserving the foods in smart ways like that, and I think I think this is going to be the year where I'm really gonna. I did one or two fermenting experiments last year, but I think this year I want to do more like 10 or 15. And how else about the wild garlic then? If you're not lacto fermenting it.
So if you're not lacto fermenting it, you can make little capers, like pickled capers from either the flower heads or from the seeds. George has a very nice recipe for Frednum George. Is it Frednum George? No, Flavor Fred. That's the guy I'm after.
Flavor Fred, called George.
Yeah, called George.
Yeah.
Shout
out.
Yeah, shout out. he makes a really nice wild garlic salt. So I can't remember his exact recipe, but look him up and then steal his recipe because it's a little bit like pickled onion Munster munch.
Ooh,
I remember,
nice.
What did I swap him? I swapped him like a jar of birch sap syrup for this salt. And it was, oh.
Very nice.
That was nice. Just put it in everything. So use it instead of like actual commercial garlic. So I just chop it up and put it in all of my cooking. The kids get to the point where I'm like, Mom, stop my garlic and stuff. but yeah, this year I really want to try and play around with like my own cheeses. We've got a raw milk farm at the end of the road, So I want to try and make some garlic cheese, which is that's on my radar this year.
So do you have like the what equipment will you start with to do that?
Well, to be honest, I'm going to start off with a really basic wild garlic cream cheese because that's nice and easy. I went to a Retief College not far away, and they do all sorts of studies with the kids, and they have open days, and they were getting you to make like butter and cheese there, and I've got the recipe. Put my head on the top of my head. I'm waiting for garlic to come around, and then I'll look at the piece of paper on how to do it that's on my notice board. So I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
So that I'm guessing I'm just gonna like chop up a load of garlic and just mix it in with cream cheese and let it sit for a bit. Or I might play around with the lacto just to really give that umami garlic flavour. Because with the lacto, instead of like, you know, one or two leaves, it's a handful of leaves. Because obviously it shrivels down and it becomes kind of this garlic mush. So you've got a lot more intense, like, whoa, garlic. Vampires will leave you alone.
It's cool. Watch your breath around talking close to people and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to ask you, you've got kids, right? A couple of kids, or how many have you got?
Two.
And 10 and 6. And what are their names?
Amelia and Beck.
Beck. And I was going to ask you, are they interested in the wild food foraging side of things? Are they under your wing in that respect? Or
they are, they're getting there. They're both quite fussy eaters, and I blame that entirely on their dad. But they love
chicken nuggets and chips type of thing.
I mean they would always choose that unless I'd say, you know, should we have ramen for tea or something like that.
Okay.
But if it's green, they're not entirely sure about it. I'm still working on them. But they will come out and they will try things that I give them, and they're like, oh yeah, it's really nice. And then I put it on the plate and they're like, what's this green stuff? Like, oh, you ate it. So I don't know if they say they like it just to make me happy.
Yeah.
But they absolutely love finding me stuff. You know, even the other day I took my son to the swimming pool, and there's a bit of grass outside the pool. He's like, Mommy, I found a mushroom for you. And he gets this little high from finding me a mushroom, and then I tell him about it and whatnot. So I'm getting there slowly.
I think if you're starting this young, it won't be long before they're full blown addicted into it.
But yeah, I mean, I have
training their necks every time they walk through the woods.
Yeah, I mean, with my daughter, I can't actually take her out on walks anymore when I've got people with me as an actual walk, because she'll just butt in and just start doing my job for me. So
start running the course.
It has gone in. But I'm not entirely sure how much she enjoys it, whether it's just I'm doing it because Mummy likes it. But her favourite teacher at the moment does have mushrooms on it, so I'm calling that a win.
Yeah, that's a massive win. That is cool.
Yeah.
Nice. So I was also going to ask you, what are some of the challenges, I guess, that you've faced as a wild food forager, and how have you overcome them?
Well, I'll be honest, I'm quite lucky. I've never really had any. I mean, I quite often get people saying, oh, what are you picking? What are you going to do with it? And I just then go into excited. Somebody's asked me about it. I can talk about wild food. And they just get really interested. And quite often I can feed random strangers leaves, and they just blindly trust me, which I think is hilarious, because, you know, I could be giving them hemlock. And they just go, oh yeah, I'll try it. So I've not really come across any. I mean, where I am in Cheshire, I've bumped into a few foragers. But I don't, there's one patch over in the Peak District where I know it's quite well foraged, and Delamere Forest. And they are becoming more and more popular because they are particular course venues. And so I go elsewhere and find different patches and better patches and whatnot. But thankfully, it's not like down at the New Forest or Epping Forest where there's bands and there doesn't seem to be hordes of commercial foragers coming around here at the moment. Obviously, I know it happens. I have commercially foraged myself, and that was a very swift education of on how to do it right. And I think it is a fine line. Obviously, you've got to be really respectful of the sustainability aspect, and I think it can be done sustainably. And then going back to the wild garlic, when I first started commercial foraging, and it was asked for 100 kilos of wild garlic, it was like, okay, well, this is going to take forever. So I just went in and I cut a big square, and then I went back the year later and I was like, oh, last year when I cut this big square, there was loads of those little tiny, you know, new shoots, and there aren't any this year. Why is that? Oh, Muggins is taking everything. You know, I've taken all the flowers and all the seeds, so obviously it's not going to regenerate. And that hurt. I felt bad for that, but obviously I was just starting out as a sort of serious foraging side and getting big quantities. So I adapted my practice, and the woods that I had permission to forage from, I just cut a path. So as wide as me, crawled through with a bag behind me. You know, when you're doing it commercially, it is really hard to just, you know, pick a few leaves out. And that is the most sustainable way for you know, the bulb needs those leaves to create sugars and energy. If you take the whole lot, then it's really going to damage the bulbs. So I just cut like a, you know, 30 centimeter wide path through this wood, just meandering all around. I couldn't tell you a year later where I'd be. And quite often, actually, picking it early enough, and you couldn't tell a couple of weeks later where you'd been either, because it would bounce back and come back. You know, so I know there is a lot of controversy with the whole, is it sustainable, is it not? And everybody's got their own arguments, and I'm sort of, I'm in the middle of, you know, it can be done sustainably with a lot of care and effort. And I think if I ever did go back to commercial harvesting, I'd be even more considerate and spend even more time doing it and just take a few leaves from each plant. Now that obviously I'm more aware of the life cycle and the fact that other things rely on it, and just, yeah, it's that whole impact thing again.
I think that's a really good story you shared there, and very honest, and thank you. And I think it's obviously one of the underlying messages that I guess I'd like to shout about is yeah. You know, I'm striving to get loads of attention for foraging and all yeah. this sort of stuff, and so is many other people, and it is obviously a rising tide of interest.
Yeah.
But obviously with that is going to be the danger is everyone's going to go out in the woods and like chop this, chop that, fill their bags, and then suddenly it's going to be like, okay, this is a bit crazy now. So
yeah,
little tips and continuing to repeat the message about
yeah.
sustainability, because I know there's no like, and I know there's a few people that I've seen online who are working towards like some sort of not rules, but like, I don't even know what the phrase is, like governance, advice, suggested standardized practice for how to forage sustainably and safely and effectively. And maybe I'll speak to those people on the podcast at some time. But
I mean, there's an association of foragers out there. I've just been to the meetup last weekend. I've just about recovered from the lack of sleep and whatnot.
Was there some foraged alcohol beverages going on there?
There was an awful lot of foraged alcohol beverages.
I'll ask you that question in a second.
Oh, thank you. I don't get hangovers, but yeah.
Oh god.
But yeah, they if you check out their website, all the people within the association adhere to the principles of practice. And it's all up there. Their main goals are sustainability and safety. And it's the whole thing, like It's like being the first person to a buffet table. You know you've got all the people behind you, so you're kind of a little bit more liberal about how much you put on your plate. And I kind of think you should have the same mindset when you're going into foraging, that, you know, there is all that food there ripe for the taking. But if you take it all, then the people, the insects, the wildlife that's coming after you, even yourself, if you want to go back for another handful later, you know, if you take it all the first time, you go, oh, look, on Instagram, you've got, you know, this massive pile of mushrooms or all these leaves and all this. You know, if you take it all, there's nothing then to go back to for you or anyone else. So go at it like you're going to the buffet table for the first time. And it is that whole the more you respect what you're taking, the more you then become an ambassador for that patch of land. You know, let's strip it all out and put concrete on it, so no forager ever. You know, we are the people that are going to be fighting to stop councils or whoever ripping out trees and hedgerows and whatnot. I mean, I was mortified last year when somebody felled all my elderflower trees. You know, hopefully they'll bounce back, but it's going to take a couple of years. And it is the foragers that are going to be looking after the land. I mean, I always go out with a carrier bag for food, a basket for food and a carrier bag for litter.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes me sad that it takes me half an hour to pick a basket full, but 10 minutes to fill a carrier bag.
Talking about that, actually, as I was talking about mental health earlier, if anyone wants like a easy mental health exercise to do, go and pick up some rubbish from around your neighbourhood and...
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I find that actually more depressing.
Do you? Oh, no. I think you've done a good deed.
I've done a good deed, yes. But whilst I'm in the act of picking up litter, it makes me angry.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't understand how people could do it. I mean, I'm probably guilty of having something in my pocket, pulling something else out and not noticing like a wrapper or something dropping on the floor. But when you go and you see beer cans and wine bottles, and I don't get it. You carried all that stuff there. It's lighter on the way back. Take it with you.
Yeah.
It drives me insane. And it's quite often the foragers that find the random stuff in the woods. I found a couple of years ago, so I was commercially harvesting in Mac Forest. I was picking wood sorrel. And that takes a long time. So you've really become sort of aware of your surroundings, and there was a mound with a stick in it, you know, like human length mound with a stick in it, and I was like, okay, somebody's clearly just, you know, buried the dog in the woods. It's the favorite dog walking space. And then a couple of months later, a second mound appeared next to it, same length, stick in it. Okay, maybe they had two dogs, you know, one goes, the other one goes. And then a little bit later, those mounds had gone and there were two big drag marks leading away from these mounds. Yeah, so it's the foragers that also find the random stuff in the woods.
Yeah. Blimey, that is a weird one.
Another one down, it's actually in my village. At the bottom of the village, we've got a river and a really good scarlet elfcut patch.
Yeah.
And I was down there 4 years ago now. Collecting elf cups, and I found this China doll head. I was like, okay, that's scary. Took it home with me because I've got a friend who's into that kind of stuff. The following year, I found a leg. Didn't think any more of it. Just, you know, okay, obviously the whole doll was here at some point, and that's the leg, and I missed that last year. And then last year, I found a doll in her entirety. She was nice and clean and just there. I left her there. She's still there. And I gave her an offering of some mushrooms when I went down to pick. So I call her the molten voodoo doll.
Yeah, there's something going on there, isn't there? Someone's got an interesting hobby going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot what the question was now.
No, it's really, we were just meandering down the river of conversation. It was all good. So mushrooms then. I know you're a big mushroom fan. So many questions to ask, and I know you wouldn't easily be able to narrow it down, I'm sure, but what are a couple of your favourite mushrooms? I think specifically to go out and forage for. We'll get on to maybe eating and stuff like that.
Oh, God.
And you can break it up by season, if that helps.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think a belete is always good to find.
Can you explain what a belete is for, like?
So a belete is a genus of mushrooms that have pores instead of gills. It's actually one of the easiest genuses to identify because of having this pore surface. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. You know, when you find your mushrooms, you're looking at Capponi stem mushrooms, which are like your typical supermarket button ones. If you pick it and turn it over and it's got pores, well, you're pretty much at your genus. There's only a couple of other polypores and things that it could be if it's not a belete. So that genus, as far as I'm aware, it's like 70 odd different ones in the UK, and there's only four that are toxic. So it's quite an easy genus to forage from.
Are they deadly toxic, or are they like
Satan's belete, the devil's belete, which I've never seen. I'd like to. It likes chalky soil, so it's sort of your South Downs. South somewhere.
Yeah.
Crap up geography. And it's not a death cap. But I don't think it's gonna make you very happy.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure if there have been any deaths from it, but I know it's the one that if I'm out foraging and I find a mushroom with any red on it, and there's a couple of Eastern Europeans that I see and they're like, no, not the red ones. Don't touch the red ones. It's the devil's belete. So they're all terrified of it. But with the beletes, a really good rule is if there's any red or blue, so if the mushroom's got any red anywhere on it, so red cap, red pores, red stem, or if you bruise it or cut it, it turns blue. Red and blue could make you spew.
Okay, nice. That's
great little tip there to sort of remember. But it's could. So the Scarlatina belete, that's a lovely red pored mushroom with a lovely red pattern on the stem. And that does turn blue. And sorry, I'm probably going to offend a lot of people. I think they're nicer than porcini.
Oh, really?
I find even with the really big ones, they're a lot firmer. They don't do soggy mushrooms. I like.
Would you eat the spore layer as well when they're big and mature like that? Yeah. You eat the whole lot.
Whole lot. Fry it up till it's crispy, or you know, just put it in a stew or risotto or whatever. I did last year try and jerky some as well. It was interesting. It wasn't as good as beefsteak jerky. And that's actually just reminded me that the beefsteak mushroom.
Yeah.
It kind of goes back to your plant question, actually. So beefsteak mushroom, I found one years ago and I fried it up and it was disgusting.
Yeah.
It was really sort of bitter and like almost vinegary.
Acidic, yeah. Acidic.
It was horrible. And I can't remember who it was, otherwise I'd give you a shout out. But somebody on social media made jerky with it. I love jerky.
I think it might have been our good mate Flavor Fred George again, because I'm pretty sure I've seen him do something like that.
Yeah. And
we'll give him another shout out.
Yeah, George. George is awesome. I found one in the autumn. And brought it home, covered it with some like garlic, smoked paprika, a little bit of chili, and let it marinate. I sliced it really thinly, let it marinate for about an hour, and then I popped it in the dehydrator.
Is that a dry marinade you did there on the thin slices?
Yeah, so just like a dry rub.
Right, yeah.
Of spices. And then I just chucked it in the dehydrator for a couple of hours. And oh my God, I had to put the jar of this stuff in my car because otherwise I would have just sat and eaten it in one go.
Wow.
But it lived in my boot, and I just shared it and ate it a lot whilst I was driving. It was like the ultimate MSG, and just it was so addictive. So I'm now like, actually, beefsteak fungus is amazing.
I'm convinced. You just sold me on it. I was always a bit like, right. Oh, it's a good one to find and look at, but
no.
I had a similar experience with it was only last year that I ate my first parasol, and oh my gosh, like, mind blown. It's way up there in my top, last year at least. It was probably my favorite mushroom, because what I did was I think recipe straight out of mind blank, the River Cottage guy, John White, straight out of his. So cut it up, soak them in milk, seasoned flour, and I also got fancy and did some spice seasoned flour, then dusted them in that, and then shallow fried in oil. And my God, dip those in whatever dip you want, and they were heaven.
breaded mushrooms or deep fried mushrooms are amazing. So I will just up at the association, and I made a wild katsu curry with panko king oyster mushrooms.
Oh yeah, nice.
There was none left.
How did you cut the oysters? Were they?
I just sliced them in half.
Sliced them in half,
and just panko breadcrumbs and deep fried them.
That's such a good shout.
God. it's also really good with either chicken of the woods or puffballs.
Okay, yeah.
They're both really good breadcrumbed and deep fried.
I've never been much of a puffball eater, but I think I just need to be a bit more daring.
It's another one of those soggy ones, but again, if you give it some crunch, schnitzels or anything like that, then actually it is really good. What other mushrooms do I love? I think my favourite one to eat is a trooping funnel. They've got such a good flavour and such a good texture, especially if you just slightly burn them.
Nice.
You know when you get like kind of caramelized
brown
bit. Oh, and the crunchy. Yeah,
there we go. Do you find they're better when they're young, middle aged, or like mature, or it doesn't matter?
Well, with the tubing funnel, the stem is incredibly tough and fibrous.
Mm.
Almost to the point where you can't really chew it, so I just eat the caps.
Okay.
So, when they're mature, immature, the caps are really small. So I tend to leave them until they get, as big as your hand, and then I'll pick them. What else? Winter mushroom, it's got to be Scarlet Elf Cup.
Okay, yeah. And
we have just had chocolate coated Scarlet Elf Cups from Charlotte Flower Chocolates. That's another Insta
page
to go and look up. She just dunked these elf cups raw in some dark chocolate, and wow, they were good. But my favorite thing to do with those is to make bacon, mushroom bacon, because you fry them up and they kind of, because of the color of them, they kind of look bacony. So I put a bit of like smoked paprika and a little bit of soy just to give you that kind of bacony flavor, and then on a sandwich with some lettuce or dandelions, and I don't like tomatoes, so I go for mayonnaise. And that's really good. Really, really good.
I'm a bit sad because I've only been living here two and a half years now, but no patches around here.
Oh.
Well, the last time I found a decent patch was in the valleys in Wales. Yeah. But what are we looking for to find these? Because obviously this is one of the few nice findables in this time of year in winter. What are we in? Yeah. We're in end of February now.
You're looking for moss. So you're looking for damp patches. It likes willow, but I have seen it on ash and a few other things. So you know when you get sort of damp, boggy areas where your branches have fallen down and then they've become covered in moss.
Mm.
That's your sort of key habitat for an elf cup. You'll see them sort of shining red through the mossy patches on the branches, or sometimes if a branch has got buried, then you'll see it actually looking like it's coming from the ground. But yeah, damp, boggy, lots of wood on the floor, and moss.
Just made me think of a few locations I probably should go and check out near me. So yeah. No, thanks for that.
it's all about sort of seeing the habitat. Because when I first discovered elf cubs, I was looking everywhere for them, but I was looking in the wrong place. A guy I knew took me to see his patch. And I went, oh, that looks like the river down by me. So I came home, went for a walk down the river, and there were thousands of them.
Wow.
I've picked about 3 kilos from down by the river, and you can still just see thousands of them. That was back when I was clearly harvesting. So
yeah.
Hopefully, now that I'm leaving them alone a bit more, they'll go even more bonkers. It's all about learning the habitat.
Any others? Any others that you get excited about?
I mean, I'm really excited about the poisonous stuff.
Yeah. Why are you so excited about poisonous mushrooms?
Excited about poison in general, to be honest.
Okay, cool.
Just the fact that, like, a tiny little molecule can just destroy your entire body. It just blows my mind. That it's just like, why is the stuff in that looks very similar to that so dangerous? Why does it mess you up so much? It just fascinates me. So I would love, and I've never found one, but I'm hoping this is going to be the year, I'd love to find one of the big five, like a death cap or a destroying angel or a panther cap, or like the deadly web cap or something like that. I'd love to find
them before, or you're just looking forward
I've never seen them. The only one I've ever found is the Inosibi geophylla. Is it the white fiber cap? Deadly fiber cap?
I think I know what you mean, yeah.
The little one that smells of sperm.
Yeah.
I find that a lot. I find it in my garden.
Smells of sperm. God.
It does. Spermicidal is what the guidebooks say.
Oh, is it? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
It's one of the key features for it is the smell. It's part of the reason why I love mushrooms. I don't particularly like smelling spermy mushrooms, but I love all the different smells. I would love to find one of the deadly ones and possibly be a little bit reckless. I would love to lick a death cap.
Really?
Because it is.
Because licking it can't actually do anything,
exactly.
Right?
I think there's worldwide, I think there's about 2 or 3 that are harmful to touch. In the UK.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know.
There is nothing recorded. Because we're getting all sorts of foreigners coming in and just naturalizing when people have plants from abroad and they've got the mycelium in the rootstock and stuff. Native UK fungi, we've got nothing that is unsafe to touch. It's all safe to touch. And I don't recommend it to beginners, but it is all safe to have a little nibble and a little taste. And then spit it out. It's particularly useful as an ID feature for some mushrooms, especially in the Ruschula or Lactarius, the milk cap genus. And the sort of safe rule is if it's spicy, it could make you vomit, and if it's mild, then it's edible. So
that's an interesting it's one way to impress your friends or make them think you're an absolute crazy person.
Oh, I love it on courses, giving people a little nibble of a really spicy Ruschula, and they're like, oh my god, how is it that hot? And it's like putting a chili on the tip of your tongue. I think it triggers the same receptors as like the capsicum in chili, that just makes your body go, oh my god, that's hot. So yeah, there are a couple of good ones out there. The peppery milk caps, one of my particular favorite, and I've got a friend who's from Romania, and they eat them with this special cheese as a delicacy, and he's like, they're really spicy, but they're good.
Oh, nice. That also reminded me of the saffron milk cap was always a mushroom which for years I was like, you know, because it obviously it's orange, it stains, it has patches, it stains green, and it's not immediately something that you would jump out and go, oh, that looks delicious, especially when it's been bruised. But I tried it for the first time last year, and oh my God, just unbelievably delicious. And it's
great texture.
Great texture. And it's like you preferred the what was it you said you preferred over the porcini, scarlatina. The scarlatina. Yeah, I think there's a lot of people in Spain apparently they much prefer the saffron milk cap to the porcini, for example, which is crazy. Yeah, and there's loads of it growing near me, so I'm quite happy about that.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those that it's a lot more common because a lot of foragers that are getting into mushrooms go, bleats, I can do them. And they only take the brown ones, they leave all the red ones. And then when you get like an orange mushroom, they're like, whoa, no way. That's gotta be poisonous, it's orange. So that the ones that
or a red cap rustula, that's good.
So you know, people get into it, just not too into it, because I don't want you to all learn the ones that I eat.
So on that note then, for, and I'm sure you've been asked this question a lot of times, but if somebody wanting to get into mushroom foraging, complete beginner, where would you suggest that they start? And I'm guessing that might also be take a course, which, you know, I agree with. But then, like, if they were then venturing out on their own type of thing, what are some of the key things that they need to bear in mind or consider, or where, what mushroom genuses should they focus on, type of thing?
I mean, take a course is the best way, because books, internet can't give you the smell or the taste, because they're so subjective. St. George mushrooms to me smells like wet dog. Everybody else says it's mealy, but no, it's wet dog. You know, and
I don't even know what mealy is.
It's like wet flour.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. Like, the books say, you know, mealy, and it's like, well, what is mealy?
Yeah. When do you last smell wet flour? I suppose.
Yeah.
Maybe if I baked more. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. So I forgot what the question was.
Beginner mushroom tips. Yes. Take a course.
Definitely take a course, or find somebody. I mean, quite often, if you have a look at the British Mycological Society, it's not foraging, and a lot of the mycologists are anti-foraging, but you just don't tell them that bit. Sorry, mycologists. but there's lots of groups all around the country. So I'm part of the Northwest Fungi Group and the Shropshire Fungi Group. And you know, they lead walks just to nerd out on mushrooms. You know, they won't talk to you about the edibility of them, but you can learn your mushrooms that way. And then if you do want to go and eat them, then, well, you know, you've got to do a lot of your own research and your own, you know, finding stuff out. Joining fungi groups is really good. And also then if you do find something interesting, then you can record it to them, and then it gets noted. And I hate to say it, but social media. I mean, it's changed a lot since I first started getting into mushrooms. So, 2013, 2014, there was a Facebook group called Mushroom Foraging UK. And there was about 400 of us, and it was a lovely little group, and it was great because you could see what mushrooms were popping up that week.
Yeah.
Because it's like you could just see everyone's posting, oh, found this, oh, found this. And I played Guess the Shroom quite a lot. So people would post a picture on saying, what's this? And you'd look at the picture and scroll through the pictures and zoom in and just look at all the key features. So what's going on with the cap? Are there any patterns and scales or whatever? Is it hairy, greasy? And then you'd look at the gills and you'd see how they're attached to the stem. Are they crowded? Have they got pores? Have they got spikes and all that stuff? And then you look at the stem and hopefully there's a bit of habitat going on. And so I'd see if I could guess what it was before I actually looked at the comments to see what people said it was. And I learned loads from doing that, because what you start to see is the characteristics that make it that mushroom. Rather than just seeing a mushroom as a whole, because they're really variable between how old they are. You know, you take a nip down to the supermarket, buy yourself a button mushroom, a closed cut mushroom, and a flat mushroom, and look at the differences, because that is the same mushroom at three different stages of its life. You know, it when it's in its button stage, it doesn't even look like it could even potentially have gills. And then you get the closed cut and you slice it in half and you see those two little white gills. And if you let it get a bit further, they then turn salmony pink and then they'd go chocolatey brown and eventually black. So you've got to look at the features that aren't the changing ones, but the ones that are always there.
Hmm.
You know, it's like with a fly agaric. You've got to be mindful that those spots can wash off.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got this reddish mushroom. Oh, could that be an orange grisette? Well, no, because if you look under the skirt, under the cap, it's got a skirt, so it can't be a gazette. It's got a skirt. So it's learning those features and seeing beyond the variation that's quite important. I mean, Mushroom Foraging UK now has got like thousands and thousands of people in it, and they do get a bit bitchy. So if you are just getting into it,
find a local one or something.
Find a local one, or don't say, "Can I eat this?" Because otherwise they'll just bombard you with hate.
Oh gosh, really?
Oh.
I like what you said there about the groups though, and seeing what's popping up, because obviously from year to year things pop up at different times, even in your location, but then from location to location, like, it pops up different times. I didn't realize that there was such a big difference in when general porcinis would pop up from Scotland to down here. It's weird. I don't know if you know, but I'd love to know, like, was that a temperature thing, or is it
likely it is just because obviously it's a bit cooler up there. They will start being cooler first. Scotland, it's wetter. Yeah. You know, you're down in the south. Good luck, mate.
Well, Danny's mum and husband have just bought a place at the northwest coast of Scotland, so we've got some future holidays up there.
Go and end of August, and that's when I'm going, and I'm hoping it's gonna be good. So social media, you can't quite see it on the camera, you want a shelf of books. Because every person who talks about mushrooms and how to describe them will tell you slightly differently. You know, especially with some of the subjective features like the smell or the taste, everybody will say it slightly differently. And so when I first started out, this one. Encyclopedia of Mushrooms, the Great Encyclopedia of Mushrooms by Jean-Louis Lemerson and Jean-Pierre Police. And it is brilliant. You know, and the thing I love about it the most is you've got the lookalikes in there. And that was brilliant for me. And I just stupidly thought, oh well, that's all the mushrooms in the country. I don't need to learn any others.
Yeah.
And now I have the two volumes of Temperate Europe. I mean, that's one. It's slightly chatty. Okay. And it's like more than 2,800 species.
Nice.
So what's in one book probably won't be in another, unless you buy something like the Temperate Europe books, which are fabulous. So a number of books, and just go out there and look for stuff. Go for a walk and find things. And take off your layers of green blindness. The more you start looking, the more you find the more you'll learn and the quicker you'll learn. You know, quite often you'll find a patch and you'll just keep seeing the same mushroom over and over again. If you're in the same habitat, so say you're in a pine plantation or whatever, you'll keep seeing the same things popping up because they're all growing in the same area. The mycelium is under the ground spreading around, so it's stretching quite far and wide, and then the spores are coming out and they're landing and going a little bit further. So, you know, in one area, you can find lots of the same species. And the other thing that I think is really important if you want to get into mushrooms is to learn your trees. Trees are really important because that's your mycorrhizal stuff. So I sort of,
if you were to give a beginner's tree lesson for mushroom foraging, what would you share with them?
If you're looking for mushrooms in a sycamore or an ash wood, you're lost.
Yeah, no mushrooms.
Yeah, so your top three, top four, are beech and oak. And they will give you a vast range of different species of mushrooms, but not always quantity of those species. Whereas if you go to birch and coniferous, so pine, spruce and fir forests, you're getting fewer species, but more of those species. That makes sense.
That's brilliant. Yeah, no, I've not heard anyone describe it like that before. And
so
really,
as a beginner, I would recommend hunting under birch and hunting under coniferous trees because you're more likely to find stuff. It's a little bit disheartening when you come home with an empty basket. So, you know, you're more likely to find stuff like a brown birch bleat. Says what it is on the tin. It's brown, it's growing with a birch tree, and it's a bleat, so it's a mushroom with the spongy pores. And usually if you find one of those, you'll find about 20, which is then really good because it goes back to my thing about seeing it in all its different variations. You know, so you'll see all the little baby ones, you'll see big old soggy ones, you know, so you'll see them all in their different variations within that habitat. Whereas if you go to an oak or a beech wood, you're just going to see thousands of different types of mushrooms and just be like, whoa, too much.
Yeah.
So I always tell people, start off with three, maybe four genuses. Start off with bleats. Start off with agaricuses. Start off with puffballs and brackets, like chicken of the woods or something like that. Because those three genus are your safest three.
Yeah.
Obviously, with your bleats, it's your red and your blue will make your spew rule, which helps you to whittle out all the poisonous ones and some really good edibles. But, you know, if you
I
get,
guess
yeah,
I haven't
you get
tasted
your ID
this,
wrong.
But there's the bitter bleat, right? That I guess wouldn't fall into that category.
Yeah,
that
the bitter bleat wouldn't
one you
fall
want
into that
either.
Category, but it's not going to do you any harm if you eat it.
No.
It's going to ruin your dinner.
Yeah, God. I haven't had that experience.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried one?
I've nibbled one. Yeah, they're
yeah. Okay.
And then with your agaricus, that's your field mushroom. So we're all kind of used to seeing those. As long as it doesn't stain yellow and smell like Army and Navy stores. Again, subjective.
Smell like what? Sorry,
Army and Navy stores. You know that kind of musty Army Navy surplus kind of shop that you get.
Okay, yeah, I'm with
I'll
you.
Put that to me.
Like old clothes, smelly
yeah.
Old wardrobe clothes
it's,
smell.
It's been up in the loft for too long.
Okay, yeah, I think I'm remembering what that smell is.
Yeah, so as long as it doesn't stain bright yellow and have that smell. Then again, you're safe. And if you do eat a yellow stainer, the worst you're going to get is friendly with your toilet.
Yeah.
And then your puffballs. Your rule is as long as it's pure white and spongy and soft like marshmallow inside, they're all edible. You know, your lookalike is an earth ball, which I think smells like old fashioned plasticine, and is really hard and solid like a potato. And that. It can start off white in the middle. And I think there is one that's kind of creamy colour in the middle. and not black like the rest. But again, you're going for that sort of squish. It's using more than just your eyes to identify things.
And it's this that's billions green. Of those earth balls near me. It's crazy. And the one thing they are good for, if not eating, is testing out your slow motion on your smartphone camera and flicking it. That's quite a good one to do.
Yeah. I mean, I do know somebody who him and his girlfriend both ate them. He was fine. She was very sick. So again,
I wouldn't risk it. I've seen them when they're mature, and I'm just like, oh no, I wouldn't. I didn't even know that they would be edible. But I was just going to say, for people who are listening and didn't know why I'd be flicking an earth ball, it's because the spores would be projectiling out of the little hole in the top.
The Latin for a puff ball is lycopurdon, which means wolf fart.
Wow.
So if you've ever seen like a infrared video of somebody farting, that's what the spores come out like.
I don't think I've ever seen an infrared video of anyone farting, but, you know, I can imagine. Wow, yeah. So almost like a volcano eruption. Boom.
Yes, yeah, smoke, exactly. Smoke plume. They're very cool to poke, and you're helping them to germinate. You're helping those spores to
exactly
get further.
There you go. Get a big tick in the sustainability.
Yeah. One of the few I don't mind kicking. I'm hoping I found a mature giant puffball last year, and I've kicked it all around my garden. I'm hoping I'm going to get puffballs in my garden this year.
That's the one thing that, I mean, I've found a rotten, mature, disgusting one, but I've never seen one either small, medium, or large size where it's, you know, in good condition. And someone pointed me on the old Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall episode where some farmer like contacted them. They went down to the field. They got it, giant beach ball size, and then he basically stuffed it, the whole thing, and roasted it. And I was like, oh gosh, that's an event in and of itself. Yeah. I just need to have in my life experience list. So yeah, if and when I ever do find one, I'll be whole stuffing and baking.
The first one I ever found was a drive-by forage.
Okay, yeah.
I don't recommend
efficient.
It's so dangerous.
Just, if you're the one driving,
yeah, it's so hard just to not look at the hedgerow. And my husband was driving, and I just shouted stop, and he was like, "What the hell?" And I jumped out of the car and I legged it back down the road and came back with this massive puffball, and he was just like, "God's sake!"
Brilliant. It's amazing how many times that happens when you become a forager, how many times you have to stop the car and get out and run back.
Yeah, so it happens a lot. I remember when it was during lockdown, and I'd just been from a COVID jab, and there was a load of sweet woodruff outside the centre, and I was just like, can you just pull over? I'll be back in a minute.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's another plant, actually, going back to the plant thing, that is amazing process, but on its own, as it is bleh. So with the sweet woodruff, it's related to sticky weed.
Okay.
It looks like sticky weed. It's not sticky. It's not as hairy. But if you rub it, it kind of smells vanilla-y. And that, if you dry it out, it's vanilla. It makes a lovely vanilla chai tea.
What did you say it was called? Sweet woodruff.
Sweet woodruff.
Woodruff. Yeah. Okay, I'm with you. Yeah. Oh, very interesting. I have to look that one up. And you just reminded me as well, I can't let you go without, because another time when I was with you shadowing you, you blew my mind when you told me about the horse chestnuts? No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, horse chestnut trees. Is that
Conker
right?
Conker soap,
yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about this. This is mad. Are you still doing it? Like, well, I'll let you talk. What is it?
It is.
How did you blow my mind?
Horse chestnuts. So not the sweet chestnuts that we roast on a fire at Christmas, the horse ones that are in a leathery husk with a few spikes, whereas the sweet chestnuts are in the really
the ones you play spiky. Conkers with as a kid in the
school. The ones you play conkers with. Yeah. So they're nice and round with that little white patch on it. They contain an awful lot of saponin, and saponin is the chemical that's in soap. So you can collect your nuts in the autumn. You then chop them up. Chop them up when they're fresh, because if you leave them to dry, I then spend ages with a hammer smashing them up because they dry absolutely solid. And then you just pop them into a jam jar of hot water and leave them to soak for about 10 minutes. So I use a little scoop about sort of this big, little pink Vanish scoops. And you put one of those in, so a handful of nuts in with your boiling water, and you leave it there for about 10 minutes. You come back to it, and all the saponins have come out, and you get this frothy, yellowish liquid, and you strain that off the nuts, and you put that liquid then into your detergent drawer, and you press go, and you wash your clothes, and that's it. So you can, if you're using the nuts like that, you can use them three times. So the second time you soak them for about an hour, and then the third time you soak them overnight. But I just get one of these great big massive Kilner jars, and just put about four or five scoops in the bottom, pour my boiling water over it, and then just siphon off every time I do a wash, and that jar sits in the fridge for a week.
And so you're still doing why do you
one for my little boy, because detergent really upsets his eczema. And it gets them in the back of the legs, and they weep and they bleed. And since doing this, I've found it doesn't have it anymore.
It's because it has none of the manufactured nasty
chemicals in it. It's another thing to geek out on and forage.
Yeah.
It's free.
Yeah.
Forage
is magic word.
Yeah, exactly. And I have found that since ditching fake smells, so like the perfume, laundry detergent, which has all that kind of flowery smell, for, and like all my cleaning products, I've gone for scentless. My sense of smell is incredible. I can tell you when it's about to rain because I can smell it coming, because I'm not surrounded by all this chemical smell that's just dulling my sense of smell.
Also very good for being a mushroom forager, because I mean my smell's not that great, but I go out with my partner Danny, and she's like, hold on Ben, there's mushrooms here. And then we start looking around, and lo and behold,
I did that at over Christmas. So I went out with Jesper and another friend, Kerry, who's at the foraging horse company. And we'd gone to Delamere Forest, and obviously Jesper's big into his truffles, and I've never found one. I'd love to. We were under Scott's Pine, and I was like, oh, there could be deer truffles here. So there was three randomers in the middle of the woods with people walking past, and we were on all fours with the bums in the air, sniffing holes in the ground.
Nice.
That was when I discovered I'd found my people.
Yeah. You know, after I spoke to Jesper, and because he does most of his truffle foraging, finding, seeking without the use of his dog, and so he is
part truffle hound, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. But it filled me with such confidence that I could just, you know, go out and just find some truffles without Buddy or without a dog. And so if anyone is interested in looking and seeking truffles and just wants a bit of, like, you know, encouragement, definitely go back and listen to that episode, because Jesper will fill you with possibility, which is great.
And I do keep,
and you've experienced it firsthand.
Every time I see like an old mature tree or something like an oak tree, there's like obvious fresh dig sites, I'm like, I'll catch you up, whoever I'm with. And there's me on my hands and knees, desperate to find one. But like you say, it's that kind of underground thing, so not many people spot them, and they're harder because they are under there, but you've got to use your nose.
Definitely. I'm very conscious of your time, and I think this has been great so far. I just have, like, you know, a couple of final sort of questions and stuff before we wrap up. But before I ask you, is there any other things or stories or tidbits of wisdom that you want to share that you sort of hasn't come out yet? But no worries if there hasn't. That's all good.
I know you said about the poison stuff.
Yeah.
I've not really talked much about poison. Poison's cool.
God,
my husband's terrified.
This is
terrified
your thing. What fascinates you about poisonous mushrooms?
Well, it's not just mushrooms either. It's plants.
Okay.
So I actually think plants are scarier than mushrooms. You know, we've said before that, you know, there's no mushroom in the UK that's going to do any harm unless you physically ingest it and start, like, digesting those toxins. But plants, like nettles, I mean, they're technically toxic because you touch them and it hurts. I mean, nettles, that's an entire podcast, that is.
Yeah.
Nettles are amazing. But things like giant hogweed. I am obsessed with giant hogweed. I love the stuff. It's beautiful. And it just fascinates me. So the furocumarin in giant hogweed binds with the nucleus of your skin cell, destroying the cell and changing your DNA to prevent you then from producing melanin, which protects you from the sun. So then you end up with phytophotodermatitis and you get third degree sunburn every time you go out in the sun. Which is bonkers, just from getting a tiny bit of juice off this plant.
Have you done a personal experiment on this? Yeah. The first foraging course I went on, the instructor had just, like, a few days before or whatever, burnt himself basically with this.
Did
you do that as well?
So I was looking at common hogweed. So earlier in January.
Maybe it was common hogweed then. That I was,
it was 2022, spring of 2022. I had a bit of a reckless spring. Decided to lick a leaf of hemlock and see if that did anything. And yes, I had some burning at the back of my throat. Don't recommend that.
Yeah.
And I'd read an article about common hogweed. And whenever people come on courses or I talk to people who have had common hogweed burns, they've always been strimming. So it's the strimmers that get splashed with the juice and whatnot. And I read this article where some scientists tested the level of furocumarin in the common hogweed. You know, they tested one plant, and it was minor. You know, it wasn't very much, not enough to do any phototoxic harm. And then they cleared some of the neighboring plants, and the quantity of this chemical increased. And they kept clearing and picking neighboring plants, and increased the more they picked. Great example of the wood wide web, where plants talk to each other through networks under the ground.
Yeah.
And saying, guys, something's picking us or eating us. Send out that chemical that protects us. So I was with a friend. I'm just going to throw out another Freya Forages. she makes this most amazing weed pie, which is like hogweed and cow parsley and cheese and pastry. It's amazing. So I was helping her pick some hogweed stems, because in the spring when they're little shoots, they are incredible. So I picked one and I was like, you know what, I'll rub a bit of sap on my arm and see what happens. And then I picked quite a few more and I rubbed another bit further down my arm. And then, like, when we'd picked our last one, I rubbed that on the lower bit of my arm and just, you know, wandered around with it, held out to the sun to see what happened, and nothing happened. And then 2 days later, I'd gone to my local rubbish tip, and we'd been doing some renovations, so I had bits of concrete, and I was like, oh, have I got concrete burns on my arm or something? Completely forgotten that I'd rubbed this hogweed on me. So the top bit where I'd rubbed the first bit of juice, I had no reaction. The second bit, I got this sort of lumpy, bumpy, weird rash. And then the lower bit where I put the third amount, the final picking, I got a very nice blister.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, it was full.
So,
full
what's actually going on there?
Test.
I know you said the worldwide, explain
so,
to
so
people.
So, basically,
what
the chemical has done damage to my skin cells and it had stopped me from producing melanin, which is the compound within your body that is a compound, the stuff in your body that stops you from getting sunburn. So actually, me going to the tip with just a t-shirt on and my arms out, I ended up with third degree sunburn. Which it's kind of a mixture of sunburn and then like a chemical burn as well at the same time because of the reaction going on with you within your skin. And I have never experienced anything like it in terms of being itchy as hell. I would have quite happily gotten a knife and just scraped my own skin off. Yeah, and then obviously I had the blister as well. I can send you pictures if you want. And I think I coped for about 2 weeks of it being like this, and it wasn't getting better. I was putting things like plantain on it, which is like an antihistamine, and just keeping it moisturized. But it was so itchy, it was waking me up in the night because I needed to scratch it. And in the end, I rang the doctors and I said, oh, I've got a common hogweed burn. And they were like, oh, how do you know it's a common hogweed? And I was like, oh, I've rubbed common hogweed on my skin as a bit of an experiment. And the doctor just called me an idiot. but it just fascinated me how a tiny bit of sap from a plant that's feeling not stressed compared to a plant that's like, whoa, my God, I need to protect myself, has done such a difference in damage.
So what's actually going on there, like with the three different burns? Just explain to people happening.
Yeah, so obviously the first one is low concentration of the furocumarin, so that's that chemical. The second one was like a not enough to cause me to blister, so it's not doing enough damage to get the sunlight down to the third degree burn level of skin. So I probably got like first or second degree burn on the second one, but then the third one there was enough genetic degeneration of my melanin to get the sun in right down to those lower parts of my skin. To then cause a third degree burn blister.
Blimey.
I know, I'm an idiot.
And so what's happening there
story.
Is the plant is actually responding to you irritating it or killing parts of it, and then it is communicating to the other part of the plant to increase the production of this.
Plants.
A separate
this
plant.
Separate plants.
So what's going on there?
So again, this is like the Wood Wide Web where they're talking to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a study done in somewhere in Africa with giraffes, and the certain trees, when one tree is being attacked or eaten by giraffes, the neighboring trees get a message from that tree to say, hey, the giraffes are here, make the leaves really bitter so that they don't eat them.
Fascinating.
You know, so I mean, it's just so cool. Nature is geeky and cool, and you know, everything out there is talking to each other apart from us. You know, all the other animals are listening and responding and smelling and tasting and going, oh, that's not right, I'll go somewhere else, whereas we make it so it's easy for ourselves with all the farming and everything, and we've lost that communication with nature. And then again, that's where your foraging comes in, because you go back and you have a chat with the plants, you hug the trees, and you know, and with foraging, and the more you do it, the longer you do it, you sort of go, oh, okay, it was a crap year for you, or you know, like last year was an amazing year for porcini. I have never found more porcini than I did last year. And then this year it could be a crap year again. And it's okay. Well, you've responded to probably a really hot summer and then a quick wet autumn and then just gone poof, send up all these mushrooms, you know. And so they're all sort of talking to each other and all responding, and that then affects how much they produce or what they produce and how it tastes and stuff. So it's, I would like to have an ear back in the soil just to hear what's going on. Somebody could
Brilliant.
invent that. That would be great. Thanks.
That's brilliant. Sam, I think that's a perfect place to to wrap things up. And I just wanted to, really appreciate you coming on. It's been
Oh,
fantastic
pleasure.
and
I have
honest
really enjoyed having somebody just
sharing stories.
talk at.
Love to have you back on again at some point in the future.
Definitely.
And just to leave people with, is there anywhere the listeners or the watchers can go and check out more about what you're up to, follow you on your socials? What would you like to say?
Yeah, so I'm foraging for ages, or foraging forages,
Okay,
depending
yeah.
on how you want to play it. Nice little pun on words there. So foraging for ages on Facebook, and the website is foragingforages.com. I am Forager Sam on Insta. I'm in the process of trying to work out how to change that to foraging for ages, but it seems pointless setting up a new one and then trying to get more followers. But if you want to follow me, that'd be great. And
And
yeah,
whereabouts are you based in the UK, just for
so
people who may be wanting to come and on a course with you or something?
I'm based in Cheshire,
Cheshire.
but I'm, you know, happy to travel about 2 hours either way, anyway. You know, so come and find me. I'm up in Lytham in March, doing a few things in Stoke, Shropshire, we've got Hawkesbury Holly, that's a very nice place to go. So yeah. Find
Brilliant.
me.
Well, thank
Cool.
you again, and I'll speak to you soon.
Cool. All right. Then. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider subscribing or leaving the podcast a review. Please also share this podcast with a friend or loved one who you think will enjoy it too. Also, in 2022, I co-hosted the first ever UK Truffle Festival and Truffle Dog Championships, where we celebrated the British truffle. At this mini festival, there was truffles, mushrooms, wild talks, interesting and quirky local businesses, gorgeous truffle-inspired food, English sparkling wine, and of course, lots of dogs. And we'll be running it again each and every year. This event sold out in its first year, and it's likely that will happen again next year too. To ensure you don't miss out for 2023, be sure to join our email waitlist. To join the UK Truffle Festival waiting list and to be notified when tickets go on sale, go to trufflefestival.co.uk and sign up. Talk soon and keep truffling.